And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you very much for joining us for today's pre-recorded show. And when we outline where our guests are, you'll kind of figure out where that is because we don't want people talking to us at 2 o'clock in the morning. If you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some previous shows, as always, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. And if you have to leave halfway through this show and you want to see what you missed, you can do that as well. And, of course, I always recommend that people take the shortcut and get the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. Now let's go ahead and plow right in with today's topic. And this week, we're headed north to the Baltic Sea. With resurgent Russia, the security environment from the former Soviet republics and now NATO members up on the southern shore, to the traditionally neutral nations of Finland and Sweden, that environment has changed a lot this decade. And what we're seeing and how that is changing, how those nations are seeing their place in a larger Western security infrastructure are some of the topics that we're going to want to touch on today. Not just how they relate to each other, but also what interface they may have with NATO and any insight we might get as well at their big neighbor over on the eastern end of the sea, the Russians. And there's some history that I think is helpful in understanding why they are taking the actions, or aren't taking the actions that they are today, and how there really have been some significant changes from what people have traditionally understood the security concerns and arrangements are for those nations. And really happy with the guests we have on today for the full hour. We're going to have, from Sweden itself in Stockholm, we have Colonel Bruce Acker, U.S. Air Force retired, and also Captain Dan Lynch, U.S. Navy retired. Bruce comes to us as the defense security consultant. He spent 30 years on active duty as an air defense weapons flight test engineer after graduating from the Air Force Academy. He served in the space, missile warning, and missile launch operations, accumulating as a Minuteman ICBM squadron commander, following staff tours, managing future Air Force and Defense Space Systems programs. He broadened to political military assignments as a U.S. air attaché to Malaysia, and to get a different type of climate, he moved over as the U.S. defense attaché and senior defense official in Stockholm. Colonel Acker published articles on regional security issues in the Swedish Royal Academy of War Sciences Journal, as well as many of the national daily newspapers there. And his co-pilot today is, of course, Dan Lynch. Dan is currently beginning his fifth year on the maritime faculty of the Swedish Defense University in Stockholm. He spent over 35 years on active duty, starting as an enlisted Marine, and upon graduation from the Naval Academy, selected Naval Aviation, where he commanded a VP squadron and a patrol and reconnaissance wing. Following major command, he served on the staff of the U.S. ambassador to NATO in Brussels and retired after his last tour as the naval attaché to Stockholm, working for Bruce for the last 2 years. Bruce and Dan, and welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to today's conversation. And it's kind of a scene setter. When people look from the outside to the Baltic Sea, they often will break things into to three different areas of thought, depending upon their background. They look at the old school NATO nations of Denmark and Norway on the western side that would guard the gate leaving the Baltic. You also have the former Soviet republics and Warsaw Pact nations on the southern shore, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and the big girl Poland. And then when they look up to the north, up the north shore, they see the Nordic neutrals of Sweden and Finland. And with y'all being in Sweden, and it's kind of a reference point for our discussion of the Baltic, let's start there for our listeners who, when they hear Sweden, they may know the name or they may know the bikini team, but they may not really understand Sweden's context and view of her national security requirements in Sweden. What are some of those bold-faced items that somebody who is studying the national security environment really need to understand to start to see where Sweden is in the security arrangement?
It's Bruce here, so you know, recognize my voice here for the rest of the broadcast. When last the U.S. was particularly interested in the Baltic, the situation as you described it was essentially correct. But that was quite a while ago. That was really coming out of the Cold War. Things have changed quite a bit in those 20 years. But the big headliner issues are, certainly from a Swedish perspective, is we were at war with Canada and from the United States more recently than Sweden was at war with anybody. So it goes back that far. And that belligerent that they were at war with was Russia. And they had hundreds of years of conflict with Russia preceding that. And most of it was rather aggressive from the Swedish side. Most of the battlefields that the Swedes would refer to way back then are in Russia as far as Poltava, which is in Ukraine now. So that's kind of the Swedish history up here. You mentioned neutrality. So the last 200 years, neutrality has been kind of a central theme, but it kind of depends on from whose perspective. The Russians never bought the Swedes were neutral. They see them as a fairly close, not ally, but similar concepts of government and the way of running their lives that the West sees. And so their democracies, they have been aligned with the West's way of seeing things for pretty much the whole time. And in fact, both the Americans and the Russians were pretty well aware, American leadership and the Russians were pretty well aware that the Swedes had a pretty close relationship militarily with the United States, even if it was behind the scenes. So the people most likely to state that the Swedes were neutral were Swedes themselves, not Russians and not American leadership. And in those last 20 years since the end of the Cold War, neutrality, even in the Swedish political sphere, has given way to a concept of non-alignment. And neutrality kind of disappeared when they joined the EU. So it even officially was no longer neutral when they joined EU, which was when, 94?
94.
Even though if we went down into the streets of Stockholm and picked a young person and said, what's Swedish security policy? There's a good chance they're going to say neutral. If you asked a professional in the parliament or in the government, they would not say neutral. They would say non-aligned, military non-aligned, something of that ilk. Have I missed anything, Dan?
I think, and this is Dan, what I think is key is, I think, as Bruce said, you summarized the Baltic area at the end of the Cold War. But today, I think the way to look at it is, and I was trying to think while Bruce was talking, is this just a U.S. or a non-Baltic perspective? But I think no matter how you look at it, the Baltic is really three players. And there's locations, but the three players or the three aspects of the Baltic security are NATO, non-NATO, and Russia. And whether you're Sweden or whether you're Russia, you're looking at it that way. If you're Russia, you only see two things when you look west, and that's NATO and non-NATO. And if you're Sweden, you only see two things when you look east or south, and that's NATO and Russia. And so it's kind of an interesting perspective to be part of. And I think Bruce did a really good job talking about the neutrality or the false impression of neutrality. But it's also interesting that the going away from the policy of being neutral, or at least the illusion of being neutral, is something that's really never been fully discussed within the Swedish society. And Bruce is right. I would say when I first got here, I got here in 2009, I would say probably 70% of the Swedish population believed that they were neutral, and they weren't. They weren't even close. And this is when they had troops in Afghanistan, and they had troops doing anti-piracy missions in the Gulf of Aden. The fallacy or the perception of Sweden being neutral, that's really it's like the Santa Claus-ish almost. It's just not there.
Afghanistan, since you brought it up, is also kind of an important watershed event in that Sweden, throughout recent history, Sweden has been very actively engaged in UN missions. And lately, many of those UN missions have been NATO-led. So I say, when I say UN missions, they're UN-mandated things, and some of them are under NATO leadership. And so Congo, back in the 60s, they've been in the Sinai since the very start. But recently, like I said, it's been all under NATO leadership. And Afghanistan, as a particular outlier, was not a peacekeeping mission. Everything else, it was belligerents that they were standing between. Afghanistan, that was not the case. And that was a little bit hard for some of the people in Sweden to swallow, that Sweden had taken sides. And there was a line, and there was good guys on one side and bad guys on the other. And Sweden was in increasingly combative environments up in the north in Mazar-e-Sharif, which was quite calm compared to like where the Canadians and the Danes were involved, and down in Helmand. But nonetheless, from a Swedish perspective, it was live fire, and so that was a big change. So that also kind of speaks to the retraction from the neutrality concept. And since in your opening dialogue you lumped the Nordic neutrals together, so that means Sweden and Finland, it is important to draw a distinction between Swedish and Finnish neutrality also. Since you were on the NATO staff, Sal, you've probably heard the term the neutrals, and when they say that, they're talking about Austria, Switzerland, Finland, and Sweden as all, you know, as NATO partners and with various capabilities. And they, all four of those have completely different conditions for why it is that they're neutral. In the case of Austria and Finland, that was pretty much a treaty agreement. Both of them said, well, neutral is a hell of a lot better than being invaded. And so they chose neutrality. I'm not that familiar with Switzerland's background, but I think it goes much further back. Sweden chose the non-aligned position more from a pragmatic perspective. And that pragmatism eventually, in order to support that pragmatism, the government in power had to turn it into almost a theological discussion. And so what started as a pragmatic decision, it became a moral high ground kind of formulation. And so that's also made it very difficult for them to get out from under, because there's no good explanation as to what changed, why it's morally acceptable to take sides now when it wasn't with Hitler and Stalin. And so the government is having a hard time explaining themselves for that. They either have to explain what has changed, or they have to say that they were wrong, and that's not an easy thing to do. And Finland, they've stayed pretty solidly in the pragmatic stance that any other choice, a 1,000-kilometer border with a hostile neighbor, is at risk, and so they chose accordingly. And I think the Americans understood Finnish rationale a lot better than they understood Swedish rationale.
Now, we've been talking. We'll give you a chance. Given up on us?
No. I was going to throw you've raised some interesting questions. I know that you had a controversy, Bruce. I think you had an interview with a local Swedish newspaper or outlet talking about the 2009 Solidarity Declaration, where Sweden basically said that they wouldn't stand idle if another Nordic country or an EU country suffered a disaster or attack. And then during the course of that, you suggested that the Swedes did not have the will. They may have had the capability, but not necessarily the will to meet that kind of commitment. After a couple of years on from that interview, are you still of that opinion?
Wait, before Bruce goes on, because I want to jump in, and this is one of the things when I think when you talk about Sweden There, you can almost look at thirds or three different parts. One is society, one is the politicians, and one is the military. And as we alluded to in the first part there, society really doesn't know necessarily what the stance is. The military is clearly, they're capable. They don't have the capacity necessarily. It's a small country comparably. But they're certainly NATO leaning, NATO, they study NATO procedures, NATO interoperability, those type of things. And the politicians walk between the two. And I think now if I give it to Bruce, I think that's, you almost have to think about that, though, is the difference between society, the government, and then the military. Not to say that, I mean, it's a democratic society, but there's three distinct feelings.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, Dan, because that Dan's much more erudite than I am, so he narrowed it down for me. But in the end, you have to be careful when you say the Swedes. It could be any one of a number of various actors, and he broke it out into the right groups for this discussion. The will to fight, if you're talking to a military guy, he'll show up with a slingshot and do his best if he has to. They will fight. And whether or not they're equipped and trained properly is another story, but there's no lack of competence, professionalism, and will to fight amongst Swedish soldiers. Whether or not the politicians will give them the order necessary, an order that they would follow, regardless of what it is, as long as it's legal, that's another story. And the context in 2009, you had a center-right government that was promoting this solidarity clause, which I really applauded the fact that they did that. And in fact, I didn't think that they had gotten the capabilities behind it, and I don't think that they had the whole of government behind it either. But what I often argued is, well, first you have to come up with a policy objective, and then you start equipping yourself, and then you start financing that policy objective. You can't do it the other way around. You can't, you know, buy a bunch of equipment and then have a policy follow it, because nobody will ever fund anything that way. So in 2009, you had a center-right government that was promoting this solidarity clause, and it was an interesting document. It was like you described, that Sweden would not stand idle in the event of a catastrophe or an attack, and they expected the same from their neighbors. And when they defined neighbors, they talked in terms of Nordic and EU, which was kind of interesting, because when you group it with Nordic and EU, that means you're calling on NATO, because there are several Nordic countries that are NATO members. And so suddenly you're getting a hook into NATO protections when you do that. And but did they have the equipment, and did they have did they really have the willpower to at a political level to actually follow through on that? The article that I wrote, it couldn't have been 2009, because I was still an attaché, and I was much better at keeping my mouth shut when I was an attaché than after I retired. But probably 2011 is when I started writing a little bit sharper, because I was freed up from any diplomatic responsibilities. At that point, I was not convinced that that Swedish credibility was as it should be, that plenty of people had cause to doubt whether Sweden actually could or would do it. Now, since then, an election has occurred, and the center-right government has lost power, and so a center-left coalition came into power. They were much more critical of the solidarity clause, although the major party there, the Social Democrats, collectively came out in favor of it, or else it would never have gone through. But the center, that Social Democratic Party, was split on the subject, so internally they have challenges with it. But either way, the former government and the current government, there wasn't any real financial change that indicated a major shift the will. The most prominent thing that happened in that election was that the center-left government that came to power ceased to oppose so vigorously. So if that's leadership, then congratulations. Now that you don't oppose it anymore, it's a lot easier to make it happen. And so you've seen things like increased exercises with NATO and sharper exercises. So they're not peacekeeping scenarios any longer. We've seen things like combined amphibious operations. There's not a very many reasons why you would do that up here, and other things of that ilk. So they're starting to show exercise willingness that is extending to following through with that solidarity clause. Dan, you had something you wanted to add.
I was actually going to say that Bruce is right on up until his last paragraph there. And I'll just challenge a little bit. I'd say in addition to an election that's happened since 2009, since the solidarity clause, there's also been the Crimea and Ukraine incidents. And what I would say is in 2009, the government at the time was also trying, I think, to explain a little bit to society why they had troops in Afghanistan and why they were doing international operations. Since the Crimea and the possibility of a resurgent Russia, the focus has been not on international operations. It is now clearly a national defense focus. And so I would say that that when Bruce says the increase in exercises and amphibious operations and those type of things, I would say it's not so much to support international operations. It's really to work with people in a national defense situation.
Yeah, don't disagree with that at all. And in fact, that's probably the theme that we ought to concentrate the most on, is that international operations are not really of interest for your current discussion, and quite frankly, they're not of much interest to Sweden any longer either. But then you have to, an American's view of international operations is different than a Swede's view of international operations, and the Baltic to us is an international operation because there's more than one country involved. And when Sweden thinks national defense, they're thinking about the traditional 12-mile perimeter around their country.
Yeah, and Sal, you're going to love this. Swedish national defense is entirely, well, at least from a maritime perspective, in the littorals. And littorals that when I take Swedish students in my position at the school, and I go to San Diego and we show mine and ASW command and the Marines up at Pendleton, and I show the littoral with photos and films, and we talk about the oceanography and the littorals and even into the Baltic, it's a very different place than we're used to.
Yeah, exactly. And first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on pronouncing it correctly. It is littorals. With people insist to call it the littorals, but I'm not going to do that. So I appreciate you supporting my minority opinion on the correct pronunciation of it. And Bruce, I'm gonna don't want you to think I'm joining Dan on beating up on you. And I know how much everybody loves having themselves quoted at you, but I wanted to pull the thread a little bit more about what Dan brought into the conversation, and that is the effect of external shocks on internal views of things. Back in 2014, right in the beginning part of the Crimean / Ukrainian crisis, you were discussing in an article, interview actually, Swedish neutrality, and you stated, quote, "I believe Swedes have been living in a world where neutrality has been a very positive, almost religious concept of moral standing, and that," you said, "it's unlikely that Sweden would join NATO in the next few years. Popular opinion in Sweden does not support this." And you mentioned, I think, which is a great construct, not just in Sweden, but in other locations, to talk about society's three views of where they should go: society itself, the military subset of that society, and the political environment. Since that May of 2014, we have a little over 2 years of time that has spread. the effects of Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and even a little bit of saber rattling that we saw east of Narva a bit ago in Estonia. Where have those three parts of Swedish society moved since you made those comments back in 2014?
Wait, before Bruce answers, Sal, I want to give you just one perspective. And Bruce and I talked about this before, and this is something that I gathered from being around Swedish students over the last 4 years. And that is, you know, most of the world took their eye off of Russia, post 90 or 91, and has focused on other things. And I can assure you that from a Swedish military perspective, they only ever viewed as one game in town, and that was Russia. And I've been told anecdotally that this is a society that has always viewed Russia as the threat. And, as a child, I was always on those rare occasions that I had misbehaved. You know, I was told, wait until your father comes home. In Sweden, the kids are told, if you're not good, the Russians will come and get you. And that's how they grew up. And so it's that's something that you have to consider here, that they've always looked that way.
Yeah, you know, in those 2 years, things have certainly heated up, and the Baltic has become much more uncertain than it was in 2014 because of lots of parallels that are drawn with the conditions in the Black Sea. But if your question is, do I think that Sweden is more likely to join NATO in the coming years now than I would have said in 2014, I would say it probably hasn't moved a lot. Public opinion has moved forward, but the largest party that opposes NATO membership, the Social Democrats, which is also the largest party in Sweden, they've dug their heels in. And you don't see a lot of movement about NATO membership. You see movement about NATO participation in various exercises. They used to formulate it as, when I first got here, the formulation from the Social Democrats was non-alignment or neutrality, depending on who's speaking, has served us well. And that has a past tense historical tone to it. And so they're talking about 200 years. Well, the current policy is neutrality or non-alignment. They're usually saying non-alignment now, serves us well. So it is now. So they are doubling down and saying it's still an effective policy. So are they more concerned about the Baltic than they were 2 years ago? Yes, they are. Are they more interested in having NATO play an active role in securing the Baltic? Yes, they are. But other things have happened in those 2 years. And so joining NATO implies that Sweden has a treaty commitment to the borders of Turkey and to other places that are a lot more distant to Swedish areas of interest. And they're not likely to want to get involved in a shooting war down there. And they have a notion of NATO that has a number of what I consider incorrect views of NATO decision making. And quite frankly, Sal, you and Dan can probably speak to this better than I can, but they view NATO and the United States as being rather one and the same. And so the one vote from Washington, D.C. outweighs the other 27 votes, I guess it is, and the rest of the NATO. They see a very tight connection between NATO and nuclear weapons, even though those nuclear weapons are all in the hands of national decision makers. So they don't really see it as a consensus organization like we see it, and they also don't see it as a decision process they can opt out of. So I have to hand it to the Swedes. If they commit to something, then they're going to, by God, do it. And so they're reluctant to commit to things as a result. So if they commit to NATO and NATO decides that they're going to go fight on the border of Syria, Sweden would say, well, I committed, so I have to do it. So for that reason, they're not going to commit.
I also think some of the hesitancy about NATO or concern goes back maybe a generation or even a generation and a half. And if you go to the Cold War, I think society, the Swedish society, viewed NATO as only being marginally better than the Warsaw Pact because of the as Bruce said, you know, NATO being a puppet of the U.S., the perception of NATO being a puppet of the U.S. and being always external, those type of things. And I think that's been part of the hesitancy. But I would also argue, and this is one of my favorite arguments at school, I personally don't see the value in Sweden joining NATO. And I know that when we were attachés, sometimes we would get well-meaning, helpful people from D.C. visiting, and they would, you know, give us the, well, get these people to step up and join NATO. And Bruce and I would sometimes say, why? Why would we want Sweden in NATO? What are we going to get out of Sweden in NATO that we're not getting already? They're already in the top third of troop contributors to ISAF. They were already, they were, you know, as the vice president just said, they always fight above their weight. They're always pulling above their weight. And in fact, what we get is a country that is capable, again, doesn't have the capacity, it's just, it doesn't have the depth that possibly we would like. But we have a country that when it sees its right, will support NATO. And when Sweden supports NATO, it's like, it's the good housekeeping of seal of approval that we saw when we were kids. You know, it's, and if you look back at the Libya operation, the two countries that get a lot of press for supporting the operation in Libya was Jordan because it was Muslim and Sweden because it was quote unquote neutral. And so I think sometimes that in a hurried fashion of it, let's get another flagpole in Brussels. I think we ought to take a look at what we'd be giving up by having Sweden join. And we might be better off not having Sweden in NATO and still get a supportive country when it sees it supportive for itself.
I remember also those conversations that if Sweden would update its view of interoperability and interaction with NATO so that there wasn't a time delay. I mean, wars move pretty quickly these days, and even two or three attachés before me, they complained about Swedish policies as having the implication that American soldiers are going to die trying to catch up with what we could have already planned for had they been a part of the operation. Whether they're a member or not is another story, but if we had thought through it in advance, the crisis action planning wouldn't cost as many lives. And that is still the case, that even the interoperability and planning that we do, like, for example, Sweden has signed and has, I think, started to implement the host nation support agreement with NATO. That's a peacetime construct. So that means that when you're exercising, you have a common view of how to get resources here and how to, you know, it's a logistics agreement for peacetime exercises. But of course, as you know, that also implies that you have a familiarity that makes it a lot easier in a crisis. It doesn't include the integration and rapid movement of forces, which is probably going to be required in the event that the Russians get frisky. So, yeah, could we benefit by them being a member of NATO? Yes. Is it worth the cost, which includes another voice at the table that may be a lot more reluctant to take the kind of measures that an American voice might want in NATO?
And also, I think, we've been doing a lot of talking, but one of the things that you talked about is whether Sweden would be willing to support in a unilateral or solidarity clause way. I mean, it might be worth us talking about some of the possible scenarios that we see in the Baltic if you want us to do that.
Well, I was just going to ask you about the various scenarios that you see in the Baltic. So could you guys discuss that?
Yeah, we... I mean,
Well, here, let me, I just went on a trip. I took the students to San Diego, and I was asked this very, well, actually the students were asked this question and by the Marines at Pendleton, you know, what do you see as the most likely scenario? And I can't recall the actual answer, but I disagreed with them. And what I see is the most likely scenario for an involvement in the Baltic, whether it's NATO or whether it's or Sweden in a solidarity situation, is a Crimea look-alike, in the sense that
Eastern Ukraine look-alike.
Yeah, in Eastern Crimea. Yeah, that's right. Eastern Ukraine look-alike, where Russia has citizens in Estonia that they determine they need help. And so the most likely scenario I see is that Russia, in an attempt to support its citizens, no matter where they are, which Putin has said that he will do, which, by the way, George Bush said he would do, that Russian troops go into Estonia, either full out go into Estonia or start off subversive and then expand into troops into Estonia. That's the most likely. The second most likely, and this is we've managed to get through probably 30 minutes here without mentioning the island of Gotland, and it's in the Swedish military blood. You have to mention it somewhere. The second most likely, in my opinion, is Russian troops are on Gotland, not to invade part of Sweden, but to take it out of the fight for anybody else to use the island as a base or as an alternate or supplies or storage or something.
But those are connected.
Yeah.
The only reason they would do that is because it's in the rear of whatever action they're engaged in the Baltic states.
Yeah. What do you think about other scenarios?
Well, I mean, the scenarios, I guess we've kind of hopped over what's at stake. Why would we have such a crisis? And we already discussed that there is pretty much just an us and them. There's the Russians and everybody else, and the everybody else fits into two categories, NATO and non-NATO, but they all have, they're pretty like-minded. There's no really significant difference between the NATO and non-NATO in terms of what they have for regional objectives. They just have different alliance structures to do it. And so of those two crowds, the Russians are unhappy and everybody else is reasonably satisfied with the current situation. So what are the Russians unhappy about? They're unhappy about, the strategic depth, which has caused them problems in many campaigns historically. So that's where the Baltic states and Poland come into question. There's the sea lines of communications. So the Russians are kind of short on access to the big oceans, and the Baltic Sea is one of the big ones, and they have to go through NATO territory pretty much in Denmark to get out. And they're Kaliningrad and St. Petersburg are surrounded essentially by NATO or NATO-friendly countries. So there's that issue, and there's the disenfranchised Russians, so Russian-speaking populations in their former territories, and they're also just irritated that Sweden and Finland are getting closer to NATO and choosing sides. So one could argue the disenfranchised Russians is also just a ruse for reclaiming lost territory or the strategic depth issue. But at any rate, those are the issues that are at stake. So if Russia were to address those, then Dan's scenario about a Baltic state contingency is one of the most likely. I agree with him. That's the most likely scenario. There's others. There's things like grabbing seaports that have direct access to the North Sea or to the Atlantic. That would be Gothenburg or Trondheim or something like that. And those would be pretty major operations and be quite traumatic. And so that's probably well beyond the little green men concept that seems to be the Russian modus operandi.
The other ones I think that are worth mentioning, and Bruce, it does warm my heart to hear him mention sea lines of communication from an Air Force officer. but it is the number the Swedes use is 40% of the Russian economy flows through the Baltic. And so they have to, if that number is correct, and I don't have any reason to not think it's correct, and if the northern ports can't open because the climate hasn't allowed that yet, then the Baltic has to be open for the Russians. And so that means some sort of possible interaction near the Denmark Straits.
I got to interject, though, that conflict is not a very good way to secure sea lines of communication. It's a good way to close them. It's not a very good way to keep them open.
Yeah. And but one thing, I mentioned the oceanography in the Baltic before. The bridge, people think that the bridge between Denmark and Sweden, you know, has closed Northern Europe. When I was a naval attaché, every U.S. ship that came to the Baltic didn't realize until they did the absolute final navigation planning that U.S. ships, for the most part, a lot of Russian ships too, warships, can't go through that strait because the draft is only 27 feet. And so they have to go through either the Kiel Canal or the belts around in through Denmark and Germany.
Sovereign waterways in NATO countries.
And the other one that both of us, I know, I'm probably stepping on each other waiting to mention, is some sort of energy coercion with the gas pipelines from Russia to northern Germany. It's been in Russia's bag of tricks in the 2000, mid to late 2000s when they start playing with the flow of gas. That has economic impacts into Russia, but they can use it as a crisis and as a weapon.
They can shut off power to Poland while Germany is still okay. And they've already got an existing pipeline and they're building another one. And curiously enough, last week, Vice President Biden was here. And of the few things that came out publicly that he chose to discuss with the Prime Minister, the notion of those pipelines being a threat to regional security came up with the Swedish Prime Minister. So the pipelines go through Swedish EEZ, and Biden, he talked about it in terms of somehow Sweden ought to do something to interdict such a development. I have on good source understood that the Swedes were pretty confused by that, because said, well, what exactly do you want us to do? It's in the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea that pipelines are an okay thing to do in somebody else's EEZ. So we need something more than I just don't like it as an argument as to why we're not going to allow it. Says if you are not enjoying having pipelines going from St. Petersburg to Germany, then you need to be speaking to Angela Merkel, not to Stefan Löfven. So that was rather interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to refrain from all Joe Biden jokes for the purposes of the show. But that wouldn't be the first time people have had a tilted head at our illustrious vice president.
But it is.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
As a Sal, it is interesting. I mean, Bruce and I were combined 6 years, no, 5 years as attachés. We overlapped for two, but we were here 4 and 3. And during those years, seven?
4 and 3.
Yeah, but seven. We overlapped. Oh, okay. But we could hardly get a visitor to come here. And and over the last year, I mean, Vice President's been here, Deputy Secretary Work has been here.
The President.
But that's 2 years. I mean, I'm just talking about the last 12 months. There's visitors here all the time now. And you can see that there's definitely a renewed interest in the Baltic since Crimea.
And I'm glad you brought up the issue of energy and money, because you really need to look at what is that baseline requirement for nation states. And that's where I think on, not to jump down a rabbit hole, but oh well. I thought that was the great conceit of that of the Norwegian miniseries Occupied, that they based everything upon energy and the requirements of Europe to the access to energy, because as you all know, and anybody who's lived in Northern Europe, you don't want to go through a winter in Europe without having ready access to energy. It's not a pretty thing one way or another. One thing I wanted to touch on, I probably should have done this earlier on in the show, but we got started on some really good topics, is the majority of our listeners here are Americans. And you see this in a variety of ways when people talk about European countries, or especially the Nordic countries, And I think it's important in a national security context as well to understand scale and size. When you look at the Nordic countries, Sweden's she's the big girl on the block at 9.5 million. That's roughly the size of New Jersey or North Carolina in population. Finland's 5.5 million. Norway's 5 million. Denmark is the same size as Finland. You know, the Baltic nation states, they're small. It's Estonia, 1.3 million. Latvia, 2 million. You know, Lithuania is the largest of the three at 3 million. That's the size of Mississippi. You combine all those together, you got a little over 32 million, which is a little bit under Poland's population of 38.5 million. That 38.5 million is the population of California. So we're talking about scattered countries. They're not all unified. They're very, very small. But you have Sweden, again, a nation the size of North Carolina, that has a very well-established defense industry. The crown jewel, of course, are their fighter aircraft, just world-class aircraft for such a small nation. The other ones, not so much. Talk for a bit how the Nordic and the Baltic nations, and if Poland applies here, feel free to throw her in, how they are trying to, whether they're inside NATO or not, to find a way to coordinate together or to match resources, because small nations don't have the luxury as larger nations of being masters of all. They kind of focus on core competencies and requirements. How do they interact together and try to avoid overlap, or is it just not that well coordinated?
Let me start, because I was going to say, you mentioned fighters and Gripen, but also Sweden has some state-of-the-art submarines, and then they're building two more right now. You're right. Each one of those countries lack the depth that we would hope for, or certainly that we've grown up with. And it's interesting how you characterize by talking about them together. Last spring, I started in one of my maritime courses. I used a term that I read from a paper, and I can't remember the author, otherwise I'd credit them. But they call it the NBP9, and I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's the Nordic, the Baltic states. P is for Poland, and it comes up to nine countries. And if you combine the arms of the NBP9, it's actually a very sizable force that would be at least a worthy opponent of even Russia, though at least Western Russia right now. But to answer your question directly, they certainly have been working together. They were working together the whole time we were in Afghanistan and Iraq, because I said nobody stopped. You know, if you lived in the Baltic, you'd never stop looking at Russia. But it's even gone more. Sweden and Finland have a very close relationship. They started a maritime surveillance. They call it SUPFIS, surveillance. I forget what it stands for, but it's Finnish Swedish.
Common operating picture issues.
Yeah, but it's at a classified level, and they do shared maritime. They've also now gone an unclassified level for all the states in the Baltic, except Russia, for an unclassified common operating picture for the Baltic. The Swedish and the Norwegians have lots of interaction in the air picture and the air exercise issues. And right now, they're also Sweden and Finland are creating a Swedish-Finnish naval task group. That started 2 years ago with basic getting staffs together. And now each summer they operate as a task group with the so their IOC with a goal, or the IOC either now or shortly, and with a goal to be FOC by 2023, I think. And the only thing that's really holding them back right now is the legal issues of what they can do in each other's territorial waters. But they've taken a hard look at the Dutch and the Belgian model for combining some sort of naval forces because they know they just don't have the depth. Now, there's one thing I do feel a little emotional about, and that's if you've heard the term NORDEFCO, the Nordic Defense Cooperation, which I think it was the Chicago Summit Chicago NATO Summit was pulled out as a model or poster child of pooling and sharing. And I would argue that that's not as, that hasn't gone as well, or is, and again, my opinion, it hasn't gone as well as people tend to make it. Because I usually ask, tell me one thing that NORDEFCO has done that wasn't already happening. And usually there's a bit of a pause in the discussion. And then I usually follow up with, in fact, if you guys are really looking at pooling and sharing and trying to save resources, how many cold weather schools, fighting schools, do you need between Finland, Norway, and Sweden? Because right now there's at least three.
In the whole idea of pooling and sharing, if you're looking for the magic example, for example, Denmark no longer has submarines. Something, it's a maritime nation, would clearly benefit by having submarines, but they don't, because they've laid that capability down and emphasized other capabilities. And together with NATO, Denmark's security is better off.
Yeah.
Would Sweden do something like that? Not a chance.
Well, because you mentioned industry, and it has to be somebody in the industry who's going to say, "Now we'll close the Gripen factory or the submarine factory," and the government has said that's just not going to happen. But that's a good example, Denmark. But it's not just Denmark. The Dutch gave up their P-3s. And, you know, there's other nations that have given up a capability knowing that they've been filled with NATO.
But, and that's not happening in the Baltics.
Now, at the maritime, though, it's actually ahead, I personally think, ahead of some of the others. But if one were to take a look at the capabilities of the NBP-9, it's actually fairly substantial.
So there's since you brought up industry, to curb your enthusiasm a little bit, a lot of the cooperation falls down over industrial questions, and because Sweden has one of the most robust defense industries in the region, they tend to try and sell their own goods, and other countries in the region are somewhat threatened by that. So Norway, for example, has some procurement disagreements with Sweden over artillery and other things of that ilk. There's been some good examples and some bad examples, but Sweden is a little bit hamstrung because they do have a strong industry. The industry requires to sell more than Sweden can actually consume in order to stay healthy and viable. And so that means they have to export. And so that then becomes a political imperative of its own. And so to lay down industry is not an interesting thing for politicians that have the conflicting goals of not only defending the country, but also keep full employment, and they will connect their industry directly to their independence and non-alignment. That's the heritage of their industry, really, is that something along the lines of, in World War II, we were neutral because had we not been, we would have been defeated because we had no capability. So they built up an industry around that. And so defense industry then became a banner for Swedish independence from foreign actors. And so now, back in the Cold War, they were buying enough of their own equipment to keep the industry viable, but they can't do that anymore. They don't buy it in that volume any longer internally, so they have to sell it. And then they become competitors to France, to Germany, to the United States, and to a lesser extent, Norway. But so that's been an advantage and a disadvantage for Sweden.
Man, I look at the map of the Baltics, and I'm sitting there going, all these choke points, mine warfare has got to be one of the specialties of these countries in that area. To the extent you can you kind of talk about that?
Yeah, in fact, I was trying to figure out how I could get some more discussion into littoral warfare. Literally into the littorals. 2 years ago, or 3 years ago now, I took the first students to San Diego, and we were doing presentations to, and I just kind of went through the Rolodex of who I knew was there. And we picked some people to go visit and talk to. And one of the things that I sold the discussion of bringing Swedish students was that they were very good at littoral warfare and mine warfare and shallow water ASW warfare. And so that opened a few doors. Interesting enough, this year when we went, the doors were already open and we were being invited in because of the renewed interest in the Baltic and because of those areas and shallow water ASW and mine warfare. And I can tell you that Swedes are very capable at mine clearing, mine warfare. Every ship in the Swedish Navy is a mine layer. And they have a very good class, Koster class, of mine clearance. They're also very good at shallow water ASW. All their sensors are designed for the non-salinity of the Baltic and the shallow water. Not saying that it's easy, but they are designed for it. And so I think they're very capable. When we went to San Diego on that first trip, the aha moment was, and this was at postgraduate school in Monterey, was that the Swedes and the Finns had no intention, at least the military officers that were with us, of going out into the Baltic or crossing the Baltic to fight. They had a completely defensive nature, and they were going to fight you in the littorals. And if you take a look at the Baltic, and you in discounting the Poland shore and the German shore, everything else, there's archipelagos. And unless you've been to Stockholm, you don't realize that. I was on the airplane coming here, and I knew that Stockholm was a port. But what I didn't realize is there's 29,000 islands between the harbor and the Baltic blue water, or actually it's not blue water, but the water. And so anybody who's going to fight in here has to be able to operate in littorals, and unless you're very, very good at operating in there, you're probably going to have a challenge to beat the Swedes or the Finns in any type of archipelago with mines and ASW. When we brought it up this time in San Diego, the answer was, as I expected, and I told the students to expect this, was, well, we don't care about the archipelago. We'll just go around it or we'll go over it. And the answer from the Swedes was, and the Finnish students were, yeah, you can do that, but sooner or later you're going to need a port because you're going to have to resupply. And that's where the they're very capable of.
The most of the show we've really focused on, depending upon your point of view, the blue or white forces point of view, and it could give us the view of the Russians, specifically the latest above the fold news about the Russian Baltic Sea Fleet was the complete, I guess you could look at it, opportunities for command opened up rather quickly at a variety of levels. Where they really cleaned house on the Baltic Fleet. And we also have the Russian half of the former East Prussia in Kaliningrad, which is quite the military outpost there. Tell us about what the view of Kaliningrad is from the other side of the Baltic, and what is the general view there on the shakeup of the leadership of the Baltic Fleet? Was that just a clearinghouse of some classic Russian corruption, or are they seeing other things afoot that might concern them?
Can you answer?
I haven't seen anything written on it, so I'm going to have to draw a blank on that one.
I can't answer about the leadership. I mean, I knew it happened. I saw it, but I haven't been around anybody who's discussed it. And, because it's Sweden, we literally just had the summer off, so we're only just back to work.
We can definitely speak to Kaliningrad generally,
yeah.
But not to this house cleaning.
Kaliningrad, interesting from a Russian perspective, I think gives them their perspective of controlling the Baltic, or at least certainly the southern Baltic. With S-300s and S-400s, you can control well out into the Baltic, up to the almost to the Finnish island chain, and then certainly into southern Sweden landmass. And so that's one of the arguments when Swedes bring up Gotland is whoever has Gotland controls the Baltic. I usually argue that Kaliningrad, if it wants to, already controls the Baltic, at least the part that counts, and that's getting in and out.
When there's a discussion like that about Gotland, I take a decidedly different view of Gotland than the most Swedes. But I think Dan said it introduced the question exactly right, that the Russians, with their rather offensive weapons and their willingness to use them sitting in Kaliningrad, are sitting in a completely different position of control than Sweden would be in Gotland with defensive weapons and no intent to use them. So the notion that you could control the entire Baltic Sea from Gotland is entirely on your based on the notion that you are willing to control something, and that's they don't have the weapons there and they don't have the intent to control it. They just have the foothold, and quite frankly, for them to do such a thing, even though it's possible for an aggressive nation to do it from there, it would be quite provocative, and the Russians know that. And if they take any step in that direction, they're likely to lose the island.
One thing I think it's worth mentioning is, and I don't know if you've heard the term reflective control. I think it is. We have a professor at the school who's an expert on Russia and particularly reflective control. Have you heard this? This is interesting. His theory or his thesis is that the Russians say and do things that cause other nations to respond, and they know they're going to respond. In fact, that's what they want us to do, and that's the whole reflective control, where they do something and they control us reflectively. And so sometimes, and this theory is that some of the things that are coming out in the press and some of the capabilities in particular, he talks about a tank that, if you believe everything, it does everything, including flying. And that's a little facetious, but the nations are starting to respond to a capability nobody's ever seen, but they've heard about. And so one of the things I think that his point is, even the Swedes, who constantly look to the east, they take a lot of what Russia says with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Well, I look at the map, and Scotland is about halfway in the middle of the Baltic between Sweden and Latvia, maybe 75 miles either direction. And Kaliningrad sits down there, about 150 miles off the Swedish coast. But Russia's got problems with that. How do they, if they need to reload, you know, whose territory are they going to violate to get back into Kaliningrad? Are they going to go through?
That's one of the other scenarios, but since it's inland, I didn't mention it. And that is, Russia goes through Lithuania and Latvia as a line of communication to Kaliningrad. That's another very common scenario that's discussed here.
So yeah, Kaliningrad does not border on Belarus, on White Russia. So they have to go through NATO territory unless they go overseas to get to Kaliningrad. And so putting a corridor into Kaliningrad is not an irrational move on the part of the Russians.
So you're saying they could be proactive in doing that?
It would take them about a day and a half. It's pretty flat. It's perfect tank country, and they could have a fairly reasonable public reason why they have to do it. And they wouldn't even, all they'd have to do is take enough territory to get supplies in and out, not take two countries over. But that's, when we were talking about Baltic scenarios, security scenarios, that's one that I actually forgot to bring up, is one of the lesser common ones, but at least common that I've heard it discussed many times.
I was trying to point out earlier, I mean, part of the situation from an American point of view is we don't realize how small this area we're talking about is in terms of, you know, when we think of 3,000 miles from the U.S. to Europe, or whatever, from, you know, 7,000 miles to the Asia mainland from the Pacific side of our country, you know, we're talking 150 miles. We're talking, or smaller areas between Russia and some of these other countries.
Absolutely. And a lot of history between the countries from the world wars, and as Bruce mentioned at the top of the show, even going back before Napoleon.
So yeah, the air defenses in Kaliningrad can almost pick off fighters that are bringing up their landing gear in Gotland. I mean, it's almost that close. So I mean, the range of those air defense missiles is, you know, 400-500 kilometers, and that's, you know, not a high probability of kill from that distance, but they're good missiles. And so Gotland is sitting right underneath the air defense umbrella of Kaliningrad. And it's definitely within range of their short-range ballistic missiles. So for that reason, Gotland, it may look really attractive on the map, but it has some significant vulnerabilities from fixed positions of the Russians. And you asked earlier about Russian perspective of things. And, you know, we on this side, we look at this forward positioning of the Russians and how threatening that is. A Russian perspective would be, well, we're surrounded.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like Custer saying, keep it calm, boys. There's plenty of them out there for everybody. I mean, we got Indians every direction we look from a Russian's perspective.
And gentlemen, on that note, I just realized we have had a very, very fast hour, and just Bruce and Dan, what a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. But before we wind things up for good here, I thought for the listener, if they wanted to keep in touch or keep their finger on the pulse of things up, if not just Sweden, but Baltic security as well, where should they look? And are the two of y'all looking at publishing anything in the near future that we could keep an eye open for?
I don't, in answer to your second question, I don't have any publications that are kind of sitting at the edge of my pen. But I do have a couple of recommendations for your first question. You have a brother here. Your blog is very similar to a Swedish blog. Very thoughtful guy that's Navy focused. Dan can probably speak to it a little bit more detail. It's called Skipper. How much of it's in English?
I mean, I read so many blogs every day. It's one of the ones, but it's good. It's really good.
The other is
Wiseman.
Yeah, Wiseman, which is air focused. So, I mean, we haven't been spending a lot of time talking about the ground. That's because you have an air guy and a Navy guy here. But then it's also a very much an air and sea environment, unless you're in somebody else's territory. So there's not as strong a tradition for an Army blogger. But those two speak to the broader issues.
Yeah, Skipper and Wiseman.
And I'd be happy to send you a link to both of them if you want to include that on your blog.
Please.
But they're quite thoughtful, and they would happily accept commentary in English. They're proficient English speakers, and they know us better than we know them. So they will be able to speak to your questions. I would encourage you, Sal, to develop a relationship with Skipper, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I don't know who he is in real Skipper, but I do know Wiseman. He was one of the students at school.
Well, I think Skipper is a public figure now,
okay.
So his name is known. But Wiseman was under the radar until finally somebody politically felt it necessary to out him.
No, he had to out himself. He was coming to school to the Defense University.
Oh, he was outed before that.
Oh.
Well, you know him, so yeah. you know the history better than I do.
Yeah, we all have to keep our capes and our masks well hidden, so to speak. Well, I'll definitely check them out. I think that's great. And my condolences to both of you for the fact that summer is ending up in Sweden. So I guess you'll come out of winter sometime in late May.
Yeah, something like that.
But again, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. And for those that have joined us today, I'd like to thank you as well for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy, and in deference to Bruce, we even call it an Air Force Day. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, gentlemen. And as a kid who grew up in Wyoming, I appreciate having that long winter. So,
thanks, guys. And hey, Sal, I really appreciate your blog. It's still the first thing I check every day.
Well, thank you. I will do my best to check my grammar and spelling then. And we're off. There we go. Gentlemen.
Okay.
All right.
Perfect. Perfect, 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 perfect. And we didn't keep you too long, just a little bit over. But what a great conversation. Again, just like we did before we started, wanted to thank you all for your investment of your time and your patience to finding an overlap between our Venn diagrams and schedules.
No, it was fun, and I tell you, there's lots more material to cover. We stayed pretty high level. There's lots of down in the weeds stuff.
Sounds like we need to invite them back, Sal.
I think so. When they're suffering, I forget what the Norwegian term is, it, but what we call it over here is the winter depression, where you have everybody under the sun lamps.
Cabin fever.
Oh yeah, seasonal depressive disorder.
Leave it to an Air Force guy to get all technical and fancy.
We just go skiing. It's all right.
So are either one of y'all ever going to come back stateside, or have you found your pickled herring heaven and you're never going to leave again?
No, I know. I mean, I get asked that question every day, to be honest. I mean, at work and friends and students ask me, my kids ask me, who are both in college, right? Or two of my three are in college right now. And so I told my boss that I would never put him in a difficult situation. So I kind of look at it as one semester at a time for me. I mean, I've been here a lot longer than I ever thought.
Yeah, yeah. Well, y'all have a great year. And again, we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Sal.
Cheers.
Cheers.